We all get scared sometimes. We all feel lost sometimes. And boxers talk about it in such vivid ways that I think would sort of resonate with people in their own lives. We might not be fighters, but I think some of the stories would move us and touch us and sometimes teach us kind of lessons about life too.
Hello and welcome to Outlines, a podcast about sport, stories and the media. My name's Owen Connolly. Hope you're well. It is great to have you listening. And what a privilege it is to be bringing you this one. Donald McRae is one of the most respected and admired sports writers of the last couple of decades. He's a multi-award winning journalist and author, probably best known for his work in boxing and biography, and as the feature sports interviewer for The Guardian. A few months ago, he released his latest book, The Last Bell, Life, Death and Boxing, is a searching, poignant examination of the modern fight game, a reflection on its many challenges, its occasional cruelty and its enduring values. Donald spent half a decade following and speaking to dozens of figures in the sport, from global stars like Tyson Fury and Alexander Usyk to others on humbler journeys through the ranks, trainers and promoters. He also traced stories of death and tragedy, giving voice to the families and loved ones of those who endured the worst the ring can deliver. And he connects all those experiences to more personal ones, from the loss of his own parents, sister and mother-in-law in the years where the book unfolds, to his ever more complicated feelings about a sport and an industry that have consumed so much of his passion and his professional energies. It's a kind of spiritual sequel to Dark Trade, the book that did so much to establish his reputation in the 1990s, and it is, he says, his final book about boxing. So we talk about all of that and get his thoughts on where boxing finds itself in the mid-2020s, the scourge of doping, the spectre of organized crime, the influence of Saudi Arabia, the spectacle of influencers on fight cards, and what it is that's kept him coming back, often despite himself, for so many years. We also look into some of the other aspects of his career, his approach to feature interviews, crafting biographies for the likes of Steven Gerrard, Eddie Jones and Victoria Pendleton, the legacy of a sporting childhood in apartheid South Africa, and much, much more. I really am excited to be sharing this chat with you. And it will be the last episode of the podcast in 2025. It's that time of year. You can maybe hear a little wintry scratch in my voice. I can certainly feel one. We will be taking a break for just a few weeks over Christmas and the new year. The very best of the season to you, by the way. But we'll be back for more in January. In the meantime, you can catch up on earlier entries of the series if you've missed any. And if you're enjoying the podcast, then, well, what a time to share it with everyone. Subscribe, rate and review on your platform of choice. Get involved on social media. Details are in the show notes. Put it in a card to someone, maybe. Whatever you do or don't do, frankly, I have loved putting these out and I'm truly grateful to all my guests and to everyone who's listened so far. And we're finishing the year strong. Here is Donald McRae. There's a version of this podcast that I did a couple of years ago. And one of the guests was a guy called James McNicholas, who you might be familiar with as an Arsenal fan. Yes. And he had written a memoir about comparing an episode of his life with this investigation of his granddad, who was a world boxing champion. And he also, like you, that Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder, the first fight in that trilogy, was kind of the launch for that sort of introspective journey. And in his case, you know, a bit more comical and a bit more, as this is one, and a bit more kind of focused on some slightly more positive details maybe of his granddad's past. But it is funny that boxing kind of stimulates that kind of emotional reaction. And I'm sure that's something we'll get into. We may also get onto your affiliations, your shared affiliations with James at some point later in the chat.
Definitely, but yeah.
What was it about, with that being sort of the starting point for the book? I mean, was the book you ended up with the one that you expected to be writing?
No, not at all. You know, when I first started writing many, many, many years ago, I thought I wanted to become a novelist. But I quickly learned that actually nonfiction can be a fantastic resource for a writer, because real lives, sometimes can be far more moving and compelling than sort of fictionalized accounts. And boxing, I think, is a sport that has an elemental force to it. It's often about life and death, and it's also hugely unpredictable. So I never quite knew what sort of book would unfold. And that was part of the, I guess, excitement. Maybe it's too positive a word, because it can be quite a bleak book in parts. But I think I was intrigued just to see how this book would change over the years.
Mm. When did you start putting it together? It follows a kind of six-ish year period of your life and the kind of boxing scene.
Sure. Just as a little context, I wrote a book called Dark Trade, which was in 1996. Mm-hmm. So it's coming up for, almost 30 years. And after that book was published, I decided I didn't actually want to do anything set in the here and now with boxing. I would look more into the past. But as the decades went by, I just began to miss that interaction I had with fighters in Dark Trade. And although I'd begun to do some boxing journalism, I just thought I actually want to do not a sequel, because they're totally different books, but I just wanted to see if I could capture how boxing was in the sort of moving into the 2020s. And so I was early 2018, I was kicking around this idea that maybe I would go back to boxing and follow five or six fighters. At the same time, my sister had not been well for many years, and she was in hospital. And as it turned out, it was the last time I was with Heather, my sister. And in the course of quite a beautiful afternoon in hospital with her, I spoke about possibly starting to do another book about setting boxing today. And although she was no boxing fan, she knew I loved it and she knew how powerful the stories were. And so Heather said, yes, I think you should do it. But a couple of weeks went by, and unfortunately, my sister lost her life in September 2018. And of course, it was a shock and there was grief, and I was having to adjust to telling my mother and father, who were in South Africa, what had happened. But I guess 6 weeks after that, Tyson Fury fights Deontay Wilder in L.A., and I get up in the early hours of the morning, because I've known Tyson for quite a long time by then. And he was coming out of a dark place, alcoholism, drug addiction, all kinds of depression as well. And that fight was an incredible fight. And I think that was a moment where I thought, I do need to do this. And I never forget, after that fight ended, it would have been about, 6:30 in the morning. It was, I think it was the 1st of December 2018. I walked out into the garden and I had a little private conversation with my sister and said, I'm going to do this book. And long answer, but it had been kicking around in my head for some time. But that was the moment, the Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder fight, where I thought, no, I've got to get back into this.
Mm. And then, the themes of the book are fairly consistent throughout. There's a few threads, one of which is that boxing itself is kind of stalked by tragedy and death, and that even in its kind of glossier incarnations, it can't escape it. Yeah. And in a way, maybe it's a way of confronting kind of risk and all the other things. And then also sport is constantly stalked by bigger things that kind of lie outside it. And in your case, obviously the difficult years that you and your family went through, but also a lot of the fighters you encounter, a lot of the people around the fighters you encounter have their own tragedies and their own difficult upbringings. And
sure.
And you then move on to kind of war and oppression and other things that are kind of happening at the edges of the ring. How did you sort of process those ideas? Because you're talking to a lot of people over a long period of time. Did you have the arcs in mind, or were you kind of going through, you compiled all this material and then you sort of went through retrospectively and worked through what it was?
Initially, it was a good question, but initially when I started, I wasn't even sure who was going to be in this book. So I had no idea what would develop, who I would include, who I would leave out. I think at a subconscious level, having lost my sister, my mother had terminal cancer and would die soon after, and then my father died soon after that, and then my mother-in-law. So in the short space of time, I lost four key members of my family. And subconsciously, I think maybe I thought I'd go back to boxing because it would be kind of a safe place. Not that I would forget death in my family, but I could get back some of that, just that sheer exuberance, and lose myself in boxing as I'd done with dark trade. But I think boxing has always been a dark business, but it's got darker. And it became difficult to just lose myself in the excitement of some fantastic fights, because there was corruption, there were gangsters involved, there was doping, there was sports washing. So I think my initial idea would be, hopefully that it would be a bit like dark trade, full of exuberance and kind of a joy in the fighters' stories themselves. But boxing today, I think, is dirtier than it's ever been. And so that hope for kind of a joyful book soon changed.
Mm. I mean, well, how did that make you reflect on the encounters that you'd had with people in the course of compiling the book, when you went back then to write it and to work through the edit and all the rest of it? Because it puts you in a different place at the end from where you were at the start of that journey.
Of course. I think I've got used to it in the sense that with boxing, the highs are like nothing else in sport, and in effect in life as well. When you're with a fighter who's just won a world title fight, it is an incredible experience, and the atmosphere is so intense. And especially before a fight, it's like nothing else. But the lows are also cataclysmic, because unlike, if you're a football fan or follow tennis, your favorite player or your favorite team will lose. In boxing, people I know have lost their lives. They've been maimed. It is about life and death, and there's huge danger. As a writer, it means that there's such intensity and such immediacy, and it's a fantastic subject on that level to write about. But you're constantly forced to confront the fact that fighters are risking their lives. And you never quite know what to expect. And say someone like Tyson Fury, who, as I said, the book starts with, I had known him since 2011, when he was not famous. But in the course of that interview, which was the first time I met him, he just bared his soul. He spoke to me about his depression and the fact that he sometimes thought about taking his own life. And basically, Tyson had bipolar disorder, which hadn't been diagnosed then. So that was a graphic insight into some of the problems that fighters deal with. But then you would see Tyson Fury, years later, and he became a cult figure because he was larger than life. He'd wear outrageous suits. He'd say these crazy things. And I think this is boxing. It's show business with blood, but at the same time, it's the humanity of the fighters that always sort of fascinates me most. But yeah, again, I just never was sure how the book would develop.
Yeah. And the other thing that comes through, and the extent to which this is true of Tyson Fury we'll see, but there's a physical cost that even the most skillful fighters kind of accumulate over the course of their career. And also the sort of addictiveness of it as an environment and as a way of living, I suppose, for some of these guys, it weighs on them heavier as they become less, they can see the end of it, and the they become less able to walk away from it, even though they should be wise enough by this point to know that they're, you know, they're not who they were. And a similar thing seems to happen as well in it as an environment to some people, where they come in and they have attitudes of, you know, being more open-minded or having a greater clarity of thought about sort of the corruption and the self-interest around boxing. But the environment seems to compromise them as well. And they, you know,
it does. And that's why I can lend to, you know, although we're talking about bleak things, I also want to hopefully accentuate the fact that it actually can be deeply moving, because, you know, fighters talk in a way that few other sportsmen talk, because I think they confront their own mortality, their own fears, their own weaknesses. They're willing to, if they trust you, they're willing to talk about these things. But at the same time, it's complicated for a fighter, because he or she has to convince themselves that there's something special. Because if you're going to fight someone, you've got to believe you're going to beat them. Mm. And as you get older, you, as you said exactly, you accumulate damage and you're no longer the same. But you have to keep telling yourself as a fighter, I can do it. And sometimes, yes, you can. You can pull out one more amazing performance and become a world champion again. But more than likely, it'll end in a defeat. And that's what I think, you know, I hopefully have captured, is that the humanity of boxers is something that is deeply moving and involving. And I think it gives you insights into life that few other sports can offer you.
Yeah, and there's the tension as well between people who are doing something deeply irrational, particularly as they get more successful, but it's often for rational ends, and it was often the best opportunity they had, whether just because of their gifts or because of the position they were in life.
Yeah,
you know, that and that comes into conflict more and more, I suppose, as they reach heights, or they don't quite, they're getting close to ambitions that they'll never fulfill.
Because, you know, there's a boxer in the book who's Isaac Chamberlain, who's perhaps the least known of the six fighters I follow closely. But Isaac had quite a difficult life. He grew up in Brixton and he became a drug dealer. Well, not even a drug dealer. He was working for a gang who were peddling drugs when he was about 11 and 12 years old. But fortunately, boxing did give him sort of a way out of that. And it became an uplifting story, how he found discipline and ambition, which he'd never had, but for boxing. And, you know, I was with Isaac when he fought a guy called Chris Billam-Smith for sort of the European and Commonwealth Cruiserweight title. And it was quite an epic battle. Isaac lost, but sure, he showed such fortitude that night. But I was waiting to see him after the fight. And 20 minutes went by, 40 minutes went by, and an hour went by. And eventually we were told, yeah, he's with the doctors and he's going to have to be taken to hospital. So I went to find him, and he was being wheeled down on a stretcher to an ambulance. And he put out his hand when he heard my voice. He couldn't see because his eyes were so swollen, but he heard my voice. He said, Don, you know, and he put out his hand, hold my hand. And again, this wouldn't happen as a sports writer, you know, in most sports, that I'm walking after this epic battle and I'm holding the fighter's hand and he's crying and he's saying, apologizing to me for not doing well enough. And I said, Isaac, you know, you were magnificent tonight. You showed so much of yourself out there. And, you know, I was torn because as a kind of a friend of his, I wanted him to stop fighting. But I also knew his whole identity was bound up in boxing. So I wanted to support him. So I think the book is also about these sort of ambiguities and ambivalence, you know, feel towards boxing. And again, as I said earlier, I think it's like nothing else in sports. And that is the power of it.
Yeah. You mentioned trust there a moment ago, and I think that moment with Isaac Chamberlain kind of encapsulates that. And there are relationships that you develop through the book. Some of them have a hint of antagonism to them, but you still kind of get honest responses from people. and you have relationships with people who are around the principals who, you know, sports people are used to having relationships with journalists and open dialogues with journalists, because they can be a means to an end, or they can be a way of making themselves understood. But, you know, you have Pat Day's brother, for instance, who you have several conversations with, and other people kind of who are not quite in the world. And, you know, that's a totally central to making something like this work. How do you build trust in that environment? And is it different? We'll go on to talk about some of the other work you've done in kind of feature interviews and biographies. Is it different in boxing from other sports or from other contexts?
Yeah, again, it's a good question. On the one hand, boxing, I think, is more open in the sense that most fighters, when you are with them on a one-to-one basis, they tend to bare their souls and give incredible interviews. It's getting slightly more complicated because boxing is now controlled by Saudi, and you know, that's much harder. But I think it's different to journalism, because when I'm writing a book, I'm spending years and I'm taking a long time to, you know, win people's trust. Because in a book, I'm writing about things that perhaps wouldn't feature in a piece of journalism. So it's different to, say, my Guardian work, where you have like 45 minutes or an hour with someone, and often you'll have an agent sitting in. In the book world, when I'm writing about a subject in such kind of forensic detail, the aim is always that it's just me and the person who features in the book, and that we can have conversations, you know, human being to human being, and not journalists to sports star. So yeah, it's interesting, and that's why I like doing the two together. You know, the journalism on the one hand, and then the sort of longer form book work. For me, it stimulates, you know, me enormously.
Yeah. Does having the reputation, the credibility help in that context? Or do you still have to kind of, I mean, obviously you have to put the human work in, but what's the balance between you as a person exhibiting, you know, trustworthiness and respect in how you're dealing with these sure. people, and them coming into the conversation knowing, okay, this is Don McRae. He wrote Dark Trade. He's been on the beat for years. He's, you know,
sure.
people know him. People vouch for him, kind of thing.
Sure. Who else has said, oh God, yes, who is this old?
Well, that too.
And, on the whole, it certainly helps that they either know of me, or I can say I've done these things, and then they immediately can tell that I'm, you know, I've been doing it for a while and perhaps I'm worth talking to. But that only opens the door. The trustworthiness can only be developed on something authentic. And if these guys, you know, people often dismiss boxers as being dumb, but most of the top boxers, you know, they might not be educated, but they are highly intelligent and perceptive people. And they will quickly smell if it's kind of, you know, just a bullshit merchant. And I think on the whole, I'm sincere and I care about the fighters. And I'm genuinely interested in their lives. I'm not looking for just a quick sort of sensational hit. And that goes a long way to allowing them to trust me, because often, even if they've spoken about something that's deeply personal, I might go back to them, you know, a week later and say, I'm writing about this. Are you sure it's okay to include it? And yeah, there'll be occasions where they say, well, actually, in hindsight, maybe no, let's leave that out. And I'll be going, damn, because it was such a powerful story. But because this is about people's lives, you know, it's important that they feel comfortable that you're going to treat their lives with care and dignity. And most of the time, I would say 90 to 95% of the time, people allow me to write it as I want to do it.
Yeah. What do you ascribe that greater vulnerability to? Do you think it's just the rawness of what these people are doing? The fact that they have to put so much of themselves on the line physically that sort of emotionally things come more to the surface.
I think so. Like, you know, someone like, say, Mike Tyson, who back in the 90s was the definitive baddest man on the planet. People were scared of him. But I quickly found that he actually was far more interested in talking about his own fear, his own doubt, his own demons. And again, I think if you're going to become a fighter, it's not something you choose lightly, because people like me who've had a privileged life, we're not going to become fighters because there are easier ways to make a living. Most boxers don't have many opportunities. And so they kind of are compelled to fight. And so their stories are always tangled and dark and difficult. But I think boxing, yeah, lends this sort of candor to their revelations. That means they are sort of unbelievable people to interview.
Okay. What do you said kind of towards the start of this conversation that you think boxing is in a darker state than you can remember it. And I mean, that's a big statement when you think of the roots that boxing has.
Of course.
Professional boxing, you think of the involvement of, you know, the mafia in the past and Mobutu in the most famous fight of all time. And, and even characters who, when you started out, you know, in some of the associations of people like Don King. What makes you say that? Why have you sort of, because the sort of the glib answer to these things is always, well, some version of what I've just said, basically. Yeah. You know, there've always been people out to exploit fighters, and there's always been kind of organized crime hovering on the fringes, sure, or some dictator hovering on the fringes. What do you think has changed in the last 20, 30 years?
There are a couple of key elements. One would be doping. Again, I don't know how much doping went on in the 1970s. There would have been, I've no doubt, because in other sports, doping was happening. But I think doping in boxing has become systematic. And world champion fighters would say to me, in their estimate, 70 to 80% of professional fighters have doped in some form in their careers, which is kind of a shocking thing and makes you wonder, well, who's not doping then? And the fighters would say to me, these are fighters who are talking out against doping, would say, I haven't been tested. I'm in a world title fight and I have not had one test. Whereas in other sports, you know, the testers are something like cycling, which is analogous to boxing in a way that it's always had a dark, murky past, especially with doping. The testing, there's no doubt, is quite powerful now, and cyclists are being tested a lot. Boxers aren't. So that's the one sort of development, I think, which is so concerning. The other is, I think that, yes, there have always been people like Don King and other promoters who have exploited fighters. Some of those people, King himself, you know, murdered someone, went to jail for that. But if you compare Don King to someone like Daniel Kinahan and the Kinahan Cartel, which is a $1 billion drug empire, basically Kinahan had control of so many fighters sort of between about sort of 2015 to 2021. And I think most people who know a lot about boxing know that Kinahan is still involved in boxing. This is a different level of gangster we're dealing with. And then finally, yeah, we had Muhammad Ali would have stunt exhibitions against wrestlers back in the 1970s. But, you know, coming up, we have Jake Paul against Anthony Joshua. Will be, the biggest fight of the year. There'll be more attention on that fight. And like last year, I went to Jake Paul against Mike Tyson, who was 58 years old. Great fighter at one stage, but a man who's a shell of himself after so many years of abuse. Jake Paul is basically, you know, becoming a half-decent rookie boxer, but he's fundamentally a former YouTuber. And that was a pitiful spectacle to be at that fight. Again, that was the biggest fight of 2024. So the combination of doping, gangsters, and then the sort of YouTube sort of spectacle, allied to the fourth element, which is Saudi's takeover as boxing. Yes, we've had Mobutu Sese Seko in as it was called then, Zaire, in 1974, now the Democratic Republic of Congo, put on the huge rumble in the jungle between Muhammad Ali and George Foreman. Yes, that happened then. But what we have now is Saudi having systematic control of the upper echelons of boxing. And I've been to Saudi three times. You know, I've written about dissidents who are facing execution or are in jail. And, you know, as much as I love boxing, I can't turn away from these other issues to do with the sport and the business of boxing. So for me, those are kind of the four elements that have made boxing darker than it's ever been.
Yeah. I feel like in each of those cases, and there's people I've interviewed, not directly on those issues in every case necessarily, but, you know, who would be saying things, different things in 2015 from what they might be saying in 22, 23, 24, 25. People like Eddie Hearn and others who've kind of accepted it as a part of the cost of doing business almost. Is that something that has disappointed you? Not him specifically, but some of the other characters around it. And, you know, there are other people who are serious business and boxing people who I had to pull an interview that I did with somebody because it was meant to come out the day the Kinahan arrest warrant was injured, was because, you know, we didn't have enough. We would never have found enough lawyers to keep ourselves safe, basically.
Of course.
You know, so I mean, have you been disappointed by that way that it's, well, we have to deal with this person or this makes this possible or whatever attitude that kind of permeate boxing?
Yeah, there've been moments of disappointment, but also I can't say I'm surprised. The money is so huge. And for promoters to work with Saudi, for example, they are making so much money, more money than they've ever made before. So in business sense, it's not a cost. It just is a wonderful profit for them. And they would basically, the old argument that, it's not as bad as people think it is. Go to Saudi and see for yourself what it's like. Well, I went to Saudi and I spoke to people and I heard their viewpoints. But no, I wasn't surprised. But yeah, after a while, it kind of wears you down because Kinahan was an open secret. No, people wouldn't talk about it because either they were scared they were going to get killed or they just didn't want to talk about the bad side and just say, oh no, he's a good force for boxing. And similarly with Saudi, people, a lot of journalists, and I understand their position, who do a boxing journalist for a full-time living, they were scared that accreditation would be taken away. I'm in a different position because I don't depend on boxing for my living. I can say what I think. And there have been a number of, you know, highly esteemed boxing writers who work for a website called Boxing Scene who are banned by the Saudis because they ran an interview with me where I spoke about some of these issues. And yes, the promoters don't want to talk about that. They just move on to the positive story. But I think as much as I love boxing, I think I need to talk about these aspects of the business. But yeah, I'm in a good position that I can sort of say it as I see it. And, you know, I'll be doing other work about other subjects. And, you know, it's not as if, and that's why I wouldn't judge anyone who keeps quiet, because if they are dependent on getting accreditation, then I understand why, they choose to look the other way.
Yeah. And I mean, that case in particular is not restricted to boxing, and kind of people make their accommodations with it. It makes things possible that wouldn't be possible otherwise. And all the
and I certainly wouldn't say I'm kind of holier than thou. For the Guardian interviews, the biggest names I get almost always come with a caveat that they've got a book to plug or a foundation to talk about, or they're selling a particular product. And then you have to have a little tagline at the end to say such and such endorses this product. So yeah, it's a dirty business, and you have to make compromises. And I accept that. That's why I hope I'm not judgmental of how people, you know, who write about boxing might not write about the things I cover. I do understand.
Yeah. That. Yeah. Did that sharpen your impulse as well? Obviously, the, you know, your perceptions of boxing and how they changed are what they are. And I think when going through the book, it's, you haven't shied away from that. And it would be quite hard to, given kind of what's, what you're working through at the time. Yeah. But did it also sharpen your impulse to look at some of the positivity and the value that boxing still carries?
Oh, absolutely. And I still, you know, that's why I'm going to still write about boxing, you know, for The Guardian, because on the one hand, you do need to be tough journalistically and talk about corruption and doping and so forth. But I still want to highlight the positive things that boxing does. And, you know, I mentioned Isaac Chamberlain. You know, that was a story which was full of hope, and generally boxing changed Isaac's life. And most fighters, you know, boxing has been a hugely positive force in their life. And also for me, women's boxing has been something that has emerged in the last, you could say, perhaps 8, 9, 10 years, with a new dynamism. And some of the best fights I cover in this book, The Last Bell, feature women's boxing. You know, I went to Madison Square Garden, saw Katie Taylor against Amanda Serrano. Incredible fight, unbelievable atmosphere. And, you know, the fact that women fighters are now, you know, earning good money is a heartening thing. And who would have thought boxing, which was such a macho sport, still is, has given opportunities to women. But again, then I come back, and I don't want to be a killjoy, but as I was just enthusing about Katie Taylor interviewing Eddie Hearn and saying what an amazing job Eddie Hearn has done for women's boxing, which he has, along comes the Saudi situation. And of course, the Saudis are not interested in women's boxing. They do nothing for women's boxing. So my sort of fleeting euphoria after Taylor Serrano was kind of curbed because suddenly the Saudis take over. So honestly, I must sound like a bit of a grumpy old man here. I'm not. I'm a positive person. I tend to see the good in people. And I see the good in sport, and I believe in the power of sport, even boxing, to change lives for the better. But when these negative forces start to take control of something like boxing, I feel duty bound to talk out.
Yeah, no, and I think it's a valuable conversation to have, even where there is progress being made, that sometimes it happens in a kind of context of compromise, and that sort of almost the impulse that lots of people feel around boxing generally, because the stakes are so high for people individually, and you know, it does come with such a cost, even if you don't factor in all the sort of political and other social elements to it. Sure. What's one thing that you'd hope people will better understand about the sport through reading The Last Bell?
I think a couple of things. One, as I said earlier, it's like nothing else in sport. And I hope people will at least give themselves a chance to learn a little more about boxing and fighters, because often, you know, as I said, boxers get dismissed as being sort of unintelligent and not worthy of attention, but they are worthy of attention. And they teach us many, many lessons. And I think I would also like people to sort of recognize the humanity of these fighters. And, you know, they talk about issues which we all face. We all get scared sometimes. We all feel lost sometimes. And boxers talk about it in such vivid ways that I think would sort of resonate with people in their own lives. We might not be fighters, but I think some of the stories would move us and touch us and sometimes teach us kind of lessons about life too. So I hope people would see that when they sort of, if they do read the book.
Yeah. Why do you think it's a sport that's always had this sort of literary fascination or kind of attraction around it, whether that's a more elevated form of sports writing or whether that's films that are made about it, or what do you think that comes from?
I think, well, you know, this subtitle to this book, The Last Bell, is Life, Death, and Boxing. And I think boxing deals with matters of life and death in such a stark way. And writers who care about stories are pulled towards it because the backstories of fighters are so kind of complicated and colorful and difficult and dramatic. And as we spoke earlier about fighters' sort of surprising eloquence and honesty, that means writers are just, you know, whether it's going back to the 1920s, 30s, up to the 70s, where we had Norman Mailer and others being seduced by fighters' stories, is because the stories are just so unusual. And also to be at a fight, you know, I've been to many major sporting events all over the world, but a big fight is like nothing else because that excitement has an elemental edge to it. Because again, as mentioned before, it's not like a high jumper who's going to miss the final jump in the Olympic final. This is a fight that it might end with one fighter in hospital or even losing their lives. Which makes you always constantly question yourself, why am I here when there is such danger? But I think that's why writers have been pulled towards it, because it forces you to look at life, death, and the meaning of it all in such a stark way. And at the same time, it's got a show business element to it, a colorful element to it, and it can be funny, and it can be compelling in so many different ways. So I think that's why it will always appeal to writers.
Yeah. Is there a part of you, that sort of more show-busy part, that has a curiosity? I mean, I don't want to date this episode too much, but a curiosity about the Netflix show that we have coming up on the weekend?
Yes, while I'll then base it on one hand and say it should not be happening, and of course it shouldn't be happening, even though it's going to make the fighters so tens of millions of dollars, and it is a circus stunt, I will get up to stay up till whatever time it is to see what happens. Partly, I think I need to, duty wise for the Guardian, in case something happens. Hopefully nothing tragic happens, but I need to watch it from a professional perspective. But I'd be lying if I said I'm not sort of intrigued just to see what will happen. So yes, as much as I kind of attempt to shine a harsh light on the iniquities and the craziness of boxing, I still find myself going back to it and just to see what will happen. But I've kind of made a pact with myself that no more books on boxing. Plenty more books on other subjects, but not on boxing.
Okay, well, let's get on to the other subjects for a moment anyway. You have hinted at your, I suppose, day job, week to week job. You're certainly a regular feature interviewer for The Guardian, and that's a as you alluded to, a very different discipline, where you might have to talk more to an outcome, I suppose, in a way that you're not when you have the kind of expanse of time that you've got. But how do you prepare for a feature interview, and what kind of mindset do you go into it with?
I think I had an editor when I first started doing this Guardian interview of the week, which was back 22 years ago now that I started it. And he just said to me, if I could learn a couple of new things about the subject, I think you'll have succeeded. Because often these are famous people and would be good to learn something new about them. So I always have that in the back of my mind. If I could just add a sort of new angle to it and learn something about them. But I think also the key, Owen, is to do my research. So I will spend, if I'm doing an interview on Wednesday, I'll start on Monday and I'll spend almost 2 days researching as much as I can about that person. But then at the same time, also having an open mind that I don't go in with too hard a preconceived idea, which is difficult. If someone is particularly famous, you're going to have preconceptions about them. But on the whole, I attempt to go with a clean slate. And in answer to your earlier question, I think it depends on who they are, how famous they are. If they're hugely famous, it's going to be more difficult because they'll be a bit more jaded by the interview process. Almost certainly they're going to have a phalanx of agents and minders policing the interview. If it's someone much more obscure, then I'll be able to, there'll be less research to do because there won't be so much written about them. So it totally depends on each interviewee and their background, which is what makes it interesting.
Yeah, and I guess it depends on how the opportunities come up as well, because if they're only talking to you, it's going to be a different thing from if you're the fourth one of the month or something, because they've got something coming up. Or
and that's why I always have to kind of heavily use a semblance of charm I've got left to the agent or whatever. Please, could I be first? Or, you know, could I do it on another day when the interview is not doing back-to-back interviews with about four or five people? And normally people, that helps that I've done it a long time. I can show them examples of the kind of work I've done. But yeah, sometimes there'll be times when you're told you've got 20 minutes and that's it. And then it's a tough gig, you know, because to open up someone, learn something new about them, and especially if you want in a conveyor belt of other interviews. But that's part of the challenge of it.
Yeah. When it's a print interview, there's something that I'm reminded of this partly because there's a Barry Hearn anecdote that comes up in the book that they mentioned in an interview with you that I did about the Barry and Eddie Hearn having a sparring session
for when 16th Eddie was about 16 birthday. Or something. Yeah.
Which they had told me that I did an interview with them on stage somewhere around that time, and it's, you know, it's part of the media game is the sort of rehearsed of anecdote that the gets pattern, polished and gets embellished and all the rest of it. When you're doing a print interview, you obviously can be entertained, but you've got to think at a certain point, right, where's the piece here? And as you say, it's that kind of finding out one or two things. Like, how do you separate, particularly because you do these longer form relationship building conversations elsewhere, how do you separate that impulse to do just have a fun 40 minutes with someone from, okay, I've got to get something fresh out of this.
I have this DAF technique that I will, before the interview, I can often have about anything between 40 and 60 questions written out, which obviously I'm not going to be asking all 60 questions.
Yeah.
But I sort of put the key ones in bold so that if the guy or the woman, whoever I'm interviewing, is actually going off on a tangent, being wildly funny and amusing, but not actually getting to the heart of the subject, I will have my key questions. I'll think, gosh, I better get to this point. I'll say, oh, you know, this has all been fantastic, but I just need to ask you this. And then we'll change the tenor of the subject. So you've got to be quite disciplined. And as you can tell, I talk a lot and I babble a lot. And I think in my early interviews, I always wanted them to be conversations like this. So they're kind of freewheeling and going all over the place. But then I kind of learned, if I'm doing these as kind of disciplined exercises, it's important that I keep quiet as much as I could. Like, you've been amazing. You've let me waffle on and then you've interjected when you've needed to. But I think I've learned to actually allow the interviewee to talk for themselves. But you've got to just guide the conversation back to where you aim for. And that sort of sounds as if I'm saying the opposite. I said to you earlier, again, with no preconceptions, which in a sense I mean that I don't want to judge the person I'm meeting on the basis of other interviews they've done. But at the same time, I have to have an idea of what is the ultimate goal of this interview. Yeah. Is it to talk about doping that they've experienced? Is it to talk about tragedy in their lives? Is it to talk about their future hopes and ambitions? You know, I've got to have some kind of clear plan of where I want us to get to. It takes time and I don't always succeed, but I think having done it for a long time, I kind of learn the key moments where actually this is the time where we go in quite hard and this is where we get to the kernel of the interview.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking of one you did. Conan Ireland was a guest on this podcast a few months ago. And your interview with him was a useful resource for that in the same way, but you did something I noticed in that one, which was because the broad sweep of the story, and it was what I focused on as well, is sort of the journeyman with respect, the pro telling their own story. And you, I suppose, because in part it was a relatively fresh memory for you, talked to him about his father and focused on that sort of personal aspect of the story. But it was a small detail in the book because it's kind of towards the end, and his father's been a character all the way through, but it draws out a personal element to that shorter conversation that
I think that's the many
other press round interviews maybe couldn't.
Thank you. And I think that's why, as I said, research is fundamental, that I'll do days of work on it. And it might just be a tiny note about, as you said, like Connor's father, for example. And that was different because it was connected with the book, and his dad features a little bit in the book. But I just had an instinct that maybe just going slightly off topic, in the sense that I was also fascinated by him as a journeyman tennis professional and how hard that battle was. But I just thought, by going that way, it might just add something slightly different. But yeah, sometimes I'll do that and it'll take us down a complete dead end. I think, oh my God, I've wasted 20 minutes of my 40 minutes on something that actually wasn't particularly useful. But I'm always looking to find a way to make the person, I think in a fresh way about their lives.
Yeah. How does that compare with doing a biography? Because that's another discipline, again, particularly when it's when you're a ghostwriter or you're sort of a sub-byline biographer, that you're, again, earning that trust, but it's not your story in the way that Dark Trade or
of course,
even a kind of historical biography that you might have done is, you know, you are ultimately doing something kind of to spec. You're doing a job where you're excavating the story, but, you know, it's...
Yeah. No, it's a fascinating sort of concept. I see myself like then more as a technician, that again, I need to be disciplined. I'm there to kind of serve that person whose book I'm writing for them. But it's a difficult exercise, and I'll give you two contrasting. So I haven't done many ghosted books because I get offered a lot, but I tend to say no because I'm doing my own work. But sometimes they're worth doing and they're interesting. One would be, say, Steven Gerrard. I'm a big Arsenal fan. You know, Stevie G, you know, this was 2015, kind of was an interesting subject. And I got asked to do his book. I went up and met him. We got on well. And we decided, yeah, we're going to do this. And I said, but Stephen, I need like a year minimum to do justice to this. So he said, Don, this is your domain. You tell the publishers this. He said, I don't mind when the book comes out. I told the publishers. And understandably, from a commercial perspective, Gerrard was coming to the end. He was about to retire from English football and leave Liverpool at the end of that season. Basically, they said to me, you've got 15 weeks to do this book. Now, 15 weeks, that's when I'm just kind of slowly getting into the subject. So, but he was amazing because it was difficult because he was coming to the end. There was all the emotion. This would be like his second last game at Anfield for Liverpool, then his final game for Liverpool at Anfield, and then his final ever game away from home. So he was dealing with a lot of emotions, but he made time for me. Of course, it could have been a much better book. 15 weeks is not a long time. But under the circumstances, I think we did okay, and he was pleased with it. And he, you know, we've been in touch since then, and we've spoken about it, and you know, he thinks I did a good job for him. So, you know, that was an example. There would be other examples where I've had much longer to work with someone, and sometimes enormously difficult subjects. But again, they've trusted me, and I will put as much effort and my heart and soul into the writing of those books as I would my own, because I think, especially if it's someone's life, you owe it to them. But yeah, I keep those to a bare minimum because I've got enough projects under my own name that are, you know, meaningful to me not to do too many of those books.
Let's talk about some of those choices. You didn't start in sport. Although, you know, you have lifelong interests in boxing and football and rugby and other things, as you say. But why do you think you've spent so much time writing about sport?
Well, as I said at the outset, I think, you know, I wanted to be a novelist. That was when I was like a teenager in my early 20s. I was going to just write novels. But I started working on that, but it wasn't going anywhere. It was difficult. I'd had done work as a music journalist, but I wasn't good at it. I found it hard to write about music. And then I kind of fell into sport because of boxing. And, you know, my second book was about boxing, Dark Trade. And, you know, that was lucky enough to win the William Hill Sports Book of the Year. And then The Guardian came to me soon after that and offered me some work for them. So I kind of fell into sports writing. And for a long time, you know, I then won William Hill for a second time in 1998 with a book about Joe Lewis and Jesse Owens. And I swore off sports books then. I said, I'm not going to write another sports book for many years. And I didn't. I wrote books about criminal lawyers, heart surgeons, apartheid. And I'm glad I did those things. And in my future, however many books are left in me, I'm going to write about other subjects outside of sport. But I think I eventually came to the conclusion that, well, I love sport. And it actually, sport is a kind of a business, for want of a better euphemism, which allows you to write about life in different ways. And it's actually worked out well for me, because although my books are categorized as sport, they're almost always about the lives of sportsmen and women. And it's given me a fantastic opportunity to meet some incredible people. And so, yeah, I will write about sport in book form again. But as I said, I'll steer clear of those boxing boys mm-hmm. for a while.
Is there any kind of point of separation that you put between the things that you're personally interested in other than boxing, where, you know, there is a kind of, I guess, emotional connection that you have with it on some level? You haven't written anything about Arsenal, to the best of my knowledge. It's not something that really comes up in your work at all.
No.
Are there things that you think, I don't want to write about that because I want to keep it for myself? Or do you just follow opportunities and stories in your independent work? How do you approach
that? I'm kind of shameless in the sense that if I think it's a good story, I'm going to write about it. And as my family will bear testament, you know, I've written about my family, not so much in this book, but in earlier books. And they gave me their blessing. So, and for me, nothing's off limits. If it's something I care about and I'm interested in. And, you know, Arsenal's, I've got a good story to tell one day about Arsenal and my own sort of absorption in that football club. So, I'm open to writing about anything. And I actually think the more invested you are, the better the book. It can get self-indulgence, of course, but I think if you care deeply about a subject, you're more likely to put in the hard work you've got to write a book. So, I'm never have said, oh, that's something that I want to keep pure and just for myself. I think, you know, I always want to write about things that move me and interest me.
Yeah. But how do you keep that professional distance? Not so much that you don't have your own investment in something, but just to be like, actually, this is a good story. This isn't just something that I'm interested in. This is something that I think I can connect other people to.
And that's, you know, I think I just get that sort of, again, instinctive light bulb moment where I'm doing an interview and I might not even be thinking about doing a book at this stage, but I'm interviewing someone and actually I think the story, wow. And I'll come home to my wife and I'll say, oh my God, I've got to write a book about this person or this subject. A lot of the time I'll wake up the next morning and think, well, maybe it's not as interesting to other people as it is to you. But I'm always looking for those moments. And there's still that surge of excitement when I suddenly come upon a new subject that I actually think, well, this is deeply interesting to me. And I think this is actually going to be interesting to lots of other people too. And I've got a couple of ideas I'm kicking about now. And I just got that sort of excitement back that I think these could be subjects that will be interesting to quite a few people. So, yeah, long may that continue. But yeah, it might just be me getting deluded and thinking, oh, wow, this is so such a good idea. And then it might not turn out to be such, but I'll keep going.
Yeah, well, we'll look forward to those later stories from you in due course. I know you're being deliberately coy about some of them, but we'll leave that part of the conversation there. There's three questions that we ask every guest. The first is, do you have an origin story or something that sparked your interest in sport?
Mine is sort of deeply embedded in South Africa. I grew up under apartheid. We didn't have television. It was a deeply oppressive society, but sport was just at the heart of white South African life. And I fell in love with sport because we were outside, we were playing sport all the time, but we were banned from international sport because of apartheid. So sport, in a way, is at the sort of source of my politicization and my opening up my mind away from childish things and asking important questions like, what is apartheid? Why are we banned? And, you know, I eventually became an English teacher, quite a mediocre English teacher in my early 20s in Soweto, the black township. But again, sport just was such a vivid part of township life and was a bridge between me as the lone white South African for most of the time in that part of Soweto. So sport is for me basically fueled by my South African past, and that's where it all started.
Yeah. What was that like, that isolationist period in South Africa? You know, I mean, I know you came from quite a liberal South African family. Your father was kind of integrationist to almost a kind of great professional risk. But when you're that surrounded by it, but you know this is a version of a thing that other people are doing around the world, you know, and there's a degree of confection when you're playing in like that, even from each other, you know, you're separating yourselves in that way.
Yeah, it was sort of painful that we, you know, thought, oh, our cricket teams, our rugby teams were incredible, but they couldn't play anyone else in the world. And there was a sense of injustice when I was a little boy of 10, 11. Oh, why won't they let us play? By the time I was 15, 16, 17, I was thinking, thank God the sports boycott is there, because it's telling the world that something bad is happening in South Africa. So there was always, again, that ambivalence to it all. But at the same time, I think, say, with, for example, Arsenal and football, I fell in love with Arsenal. Obviously, in South Africa, we didn't have television, so I never saw Arsenal. You know, I couldn't go see them because I was in a different continent. But I would get Shoot magazine, which was this old football magazine that came out each weekly. I would get it sort of 6 weeks late because it was shipped. But I developed this love for English football, and I listened to the World Service and those evocative late Saturday afternoon BBC World Service commentaries with commentators like Peter Jones were amazing. So my understanding of sport was sometimes not visual. It was all audio and in my imagination. So it's quite an unusual way how I came into football, for example. So I think in a way the difficulties we faced as South Africans in the sense of isolation actually, for me personally, were of enormous benefit and made me think about sports in different ways than I think if I'd been based in the UK or the US or other countries.
Okay. What's your favorite piece of sports storytelling?
There are many. I think there's a book called, I know there's a book called King of the World by David Remnick, who's the editor of The New Yorker. And that's ostensibly, again, about boxing, but actually it's much more about sort of the politics of the United States in the 1960s. And it looks at Muhammad Ali, Floyd Patterson, and Sonny Liston. And just in a short space of time, it looks at about 3-4 years in the lives of these three men. And it was a time when Muhammad Ali had taken his name. He'd given up his name of Cassius Clay to become Muhammad Ali. And I think that is a fantastic book that captures the power of sport, but it's got a much wider context. So I always recommend that book to anyone who's sort of interested in sport, boxing, politics, life. I think all those elements are in that book.
Okay. And we've touched on it a bit, but what's a sports story you'd like to tell or see someone else tell? Maybe you could focus on someone else, given that you're kind of incubating ideas yourself.
There's a couple of stories that I would like to sort of see being told, but I kind of like to tell them myself, and I'm in early stages. So if you don't mind, I'm again being coy. I just want to just see how those develop. The other one, I'd have to come back to you. I can't think, there'll be so many fantastic writers who I could, you know, with a bit more thought, think, oh, well, I'd like to see what they would do with certain subjects. But at the moment, I'm in that weird sort of limbo between books. And so I've got these sort of ideas boiling away in my head, and they might turn out to be duds. So I'll just keep them quiet for the moment. But, you know, so apologies for not being able to answer that question.
That's fine. You've been very generous with all the others. Don, it's been an absolute pleasure. It's been a fascinating hour.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for your time, and it's been wonderful talking to you.
Outlines is an original production from 2640.